Okay, thank you. And let's, I'll tell you what, let's turn to the Torah portion for this evening. Now, this is a little bit different, as you probably would suspect, because we are now into the, really the heart approaching of the fall feasts. We're coming up on Yom Teruah next week, so the traditional, Yom Kippur next week. The traditional Torah portion to read this week is actually, from Leviticus 16, but I'm gonna add to it some of the other things that have to do with the feast, and, we'll mix a number of things in there. The Haf Torah portion is appropriate as well, at least part of the story. And I'm going to contend that there are some other ones that we will expose ourselves to also, because I think they fit. And I'll probably mix in a little bit of the news. The news is going to be something that we're going to spend some time on this evening as well. So turn with me, if you will, first to Leviticus chapter 16. And we'll start with that one. This is essentially the description of the two goats. One, Le Yahuwah, and the other, Le Azazel. And it's, of course, the sacrifice, I guess you'd call it the ceremony that is representative of Yom Kippur. We don't necessarily do the ceremony anymore. We don't have some of the things. We don't have the high priest. We don't have, some of the things that would be appropriate to that. But there are some things in the story that are interesting. And as we go through this evening, I want to try to kind of lay out a number of things. And in the time that we have available, I don't intend to try to say we're going to do a definitive teaching of everything there is to say about Yom Kippur or the fall feasts, but I do want to try to lay out a few things. And in particular, and we'll see some of this when we get to the news, I will contend that, this, folks, may be the most important Yom Kippur of our lives. We don't know that yet, and I guess that's the proper attitude to go into every Yom Kippur, that it's the most important one of my life so far. And I need to be ready for what may happen. I did some of the Come Out of Her, My People show this week with this same theme. People say, well, you know, I want to be prepared. I want to come out. I want to be ready. You know, people that come out of the ex-Christianity will even say sometimes rapture ready. And of course, if we really want to be ready, and this is why I want to spend some time, and by the way, questions, as always, are welcome, if you got them, because I know that all of us have family members that we're dealing with that say, oh, why are you keeping those Jewish feasts, right? Well, we already know the answer to that, because they're not necessarily Jewish feasts. No offense to anybody that has that heritage, but these are the feasts of Yod Heh Vav-Heh. They're the feasts of Yahuwah. He says so. They're mine. And that's one of the verses I'm going to go to in chapter 10 of Isaiah in a few minutes. He draws a distinction between the feasts of men, those things that we've been told to do instead. And if it was upsetting to him, some of the things that they were doing, you know, your new moons, your Sabbaths, they are a stench in my nostrils. How much more so then things that are utterly pagan, and the people who do it ought to know it. And I'm talking about the priests and the pastors primarily, that these things come right smack out of paganism. They're not his feasts. And if there's ever a time during the year to be getting ourselves cleaned up and to be aware of it, it's at Yom Kippur. Because the essence of Yom Kippur is teshuvah and to be ready for what lies ahead. Which brings me back to this idea of the Azazel. It says, speak to the children of Israel on the 10th day of the 7th month. You're going to have this feast, a solemn rest unto you, a memorial proclaimed with a blast of horns. Kicks things off. We start to count. And on the 10th day of the month, we come to the Day of Atonement. There shall be, it says, a holy convocation unto you. You shall afflict your souls. You shall bring an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah, and you shall do no manner of work in that same day. For it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before Yahuwah Eloheka, the Lord your God. So, any soul, it says, I'm looking at chapter 23 at this point. I'm going to mix these up because I'll try to tell you which ones we're looking at in which place, and we'll make sure people, too, have all three of them kind of at hand so that you can... Well, again, when people ask you, you can give an account for those things that you do and those things you believe. But here's a good reason for keeping his feasts, and this one in particular. For whatsoever soul it be that shall not be afflicted in that same day, he shall be cut off from his people. That sounds like a pretty severe attitude to me. Any soul that does any manner of work in that day, that same soul will I destroy from among his people. Are we kind of starting to get the impression? I want to make this as clear as I can, and I don't want to be... I want to try to be blunt about it. This is an important time. I think more and more of us are beginning to look at the news and see what's going on and go, yeah, things are really, really coming to a head. It's getting downright ugly out there. And if there was ever something that's important, and ever a time where we can look out and see his handiwork and see his plan coming together and say, okay, now, Father, what do I need to do today? Answer, keep my feasts. Do the things that I've been commanding you to do. These things that I said shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. We haven't been doing them for the most part. A lot of us are beginning to try now. We're coming out of it. But I doubt there are too many of us that don't at least have friends, if not family, sometimes close relatives, that may not be on board and need our encouragement, need support, and they may need a little chastening. They may need us to be able to go to Scripture and say, look, what does that say to you? Whatsoever soul that does any matter of work in that same day, that soul will I destroy from among his people. Do you love your wives, your children, your families, your brothers and sisters or in-laws or whatever it may be? Well, the least we can do is blow the shofar for them, warn them, and let them know, hey, can you see what's coming down? If you haven't gotten it yet, it's a great opportunity to do that. All right, so I'm going to lay out two other things. I'm kind of skipping around in my notes here, and that's okay. Same thing goes for questions, locally or online. If I say something that you go, what? I don't think I'd noticed that before. We'll come back and talk about it. Now, I'm going to go to the Azazel, this idea of the two goats, because I saw an interesting article put some of those things together. I like that. I think it's a good picture for us to have in our heads. But I really want to begin with Isaiah chapter 10. And we may end with Isaiah 66. Isaiah is one of those prophets that, like all of them, had the same message, Teshuva, turn around, you're going the wrong direction. And in particular, chapter 10 here talks about, this is the one that I referenced. Oh, I'm sorry, that's why I misspoke. It's my fault. It's Isaiah 1, verse 10. That makes more sense, doesn't it? Okay. Isaiah 1, chapter 1. I was thinking it was right early on in the prophet's discussion of things. Isaiah 1, verse 10. So give everybody else a second to catch up with me since I'm behind. Ha ha. Hear the word of Yahuwah, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear unto the Torah of our Elohim, you people of Gomorrah. Let's pause right there. Think about the time frame here. This is Isaiah well after the time of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? That happened way back in the book of Genesis. Who's he talking to? People of Sodom? People of Gomorrah are dead. They were destroyed. Well, clearly we're talking about a spiritual metaphor here. And if it applied to the people of Isaiah's time, and it applies to a number of people in the time after that, I'm going to contend, boy, it seems to me like it certainly applies today, too. There's a whole lot of people that I would say ought to be listening, you rulers of Sodom, Washington, D.C., you know, Sodom on the Potomac. Hear the word of Yahuwah, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear unto the Torah of our Elohim, you people of Gomorrah. What are you bothering to do all these sacrifices? By the way, they're not sacrifices to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh that we see in America today anyway. I'm full of it. The burnt offerings of rams, the fat of fed beasts. I don't delight in these things. When you come to appear before me, who has required this at your hand to tread my courts? In other words, he's asking this question, where'd you get all this stuff that you're doing? Don't bring me any more vain oblations. Incense. Your incense, it's an abomination unto me. Your new moons. If you look into Hebrew, the word here is, it's in the tense that says, hey, your new moons, your Sabbaths, your solemn assemblies, I can't handle. It is iniquity, even the solemn meeting. Your new moons, your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They're a trouble to me. I'm weary to bear them. When you spread forth your hands, I'll hide my eyes from you. When you make many prayers, I won't hear, because your hands are full of blood. So, wash yourselves, make you clean, put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes, and cease to do evil. I'll pause right there, because I'm going to suggest to you that the time of Yom Kippur is all about getting cleaned up, about teshuvah, ceasing to do evil, returning to Him, and recognizing that the things that we have for so long said, well, you know, all that old stuff, those feasts of the Jews, that's all done away with. We don't do that anymore. Well, he emphasizes it, I emphasize it. He says, keep it forever throughout your generations. So what about the word forever don't we understand? And here, when we kind of start to put these pieces together, we can see what Isaiah is telling them. Your new moons, these things that you're bringing before me, again, Christmas, Easter, anybody, are an abomination. I'm sick of them. Which brings me now to the two goats. Verse 8, back to chapter 16, Leviticus. Aaron is to cast lots upon these two goats. One lot for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Le-Yahuwah. The other lot for Azazel. And we'll come back in a second. What does Azazel mean? And one of them, the lot that is for Yahuwah, is going to be offered for a sin offering. But the other one, the one that fell on Azazel, he is to be set alive before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to make atonement over him. He's to be sent away. That word there is shalach. Same word we use when a husband sends an unfaithful wife out. When Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh sent Israel out because of her whoring. He's to be sent away into the wilderness. By the way, I think there's a parallel there. Now, at that point, I'm going to pause. I think most everybody knows at least part of the story about what's involved. But I like a couple of things I saw in a piece this week about the goat for Azazel. And there's a connection that is made, and a lot of the Midrashim, the various Midrashes that you'll see out there, about twins. How do twins relate to these two goats? Oh, and there's another connection, too. The two sons of Aaron that were killed, Nadab and Abihu. And I like the way this is put. There's an ancient rabbi that suggested that the sin of Nadab and Abihu resulted from unbridled passion and the love of God. These weren't necessarily evil guys. They just got a little carried away. Yeah, they had a little bit of a nip before they went in. That probably helped. But essentially, what most of the people that have read the story seem to agree on, and I'm not going to argue with this, is that they weren't trying to do evil. They were just trying, well, you know how it goes. God knows my heart. I'm really excited. I'm full of the Holy Spirit. Gonna go into that temple. Gonna go into the Holy of Holies. Gonna do all this good stuff. God will love it. He's got to. Answer? He didn't. He killed him. So I like the way this is put. It was unbridled passion, reacting to the joy and acting out of a feeling of ecstasy, says the way this author puts it. Nadab and Abihu approached God in an improper manner, a manner in which he did not tell them to, and it cost them their lives. And he says this, and I think there's a lesson here, and I'm going to draw the parallels to you know, a lot of the so-called worship. Oh, you know, I know that maybe the Christmas tree isn't the greatest thing, but family loves it. You know, God understands my heart. Oh, and those Ishtar eggs and all that good stuff we do at sunrise service. Yeah, I know there's pagan stuff, but God knows my heart. He'll love it. He has to, because you know, my heart's pure. I got this great feeling. I feel really good about my Sunday best and my Ishtar services and my sunrise service. Makes me feel really, really religious. Well, the message of Nadab and Abihu is clear, say this author. The pitfall of religious experience born of ecstasy is trying to create a relationship that is not wanted by God. And by the way, it's kind of the opposite of Yom Kippur. We're going to keep coming back to that. To act out of ecstasy alone, he says, is to make the experience subjective and selfish. It's the one that the worshiper may think he wants, but it's not the one that is desired by the object of worship. It may even mean crossing the line between creating a God in his own image instead of manifesting the way it is that our Creator wants us to be. worshiping the image of Yod Heh Vav Heh within ourselves. That doesn't mean, they always point out, you got to have the caveat, that that there can't be some good comes out of ecstatic religious experiences. That can happen. We all desire a joyful relationship with Yod Heh Vav Heh. Indeed, we talked about it just a couple weeks ago. We're commanded to be joyful when we bring our thanks before Him. But here's the key. I'm going to underline this. Such a relationship can only be developed from a desire to please Yod Heh Vav Heh in the manner that He has taught us that He wants to be pleased. It's not about what He ought to want based on the desires of our hearts or the mixing of the clean and the unclean and all this paganism. It's about learning what it is that He wants us to do. And great, you're full of ecstasy. Well, leave it at home. Don't bring it into my solemn assembly. Not in a manner that is offensive to me. Now, I'm going to stop here. I don't often do this, but I will this evening. We have a new puppy. Some of you have heard me talking about it. He's running around here somewhere right now. And, you know, puppies can be willful, and puppies can be a handful, and all that kind of stuff. But as I was looking at this and putting my notes together tonight, it dawned on me just a little over an hour ago as the puppy was doing something I did not want. The puppy was downright exuberant. He was having a religious experience, born of ecstasy, trying to create a relationship with his master. He was biting me, and I didn't like it. And he knows better than that. Bite, bite, bite. And I've told him not. And he knows, by the way, what the word no means by now. And I've told him so many times that I'm kind of getting a little bit frustrated about it from time to time. You know what? I know that sometimes the puppy trainers say this is not the right thing to do, but I tell you from firsthand experience, it seems to work. That when all else fails and the puppy still has this religious experience and he's looking for a relationship with his new master and he's all excited, he needs a SWAT. And there are times, folks, when I think our Creator feels the very same way. Mm-hmm. By the way, yeah, I see the comments online. He's got lots of chew toys. He's got other things to chew. You know what? He's got all that. And sometimes I would say he's without excuse. He knows he's not supposed to be chewing on my leg or my pants, and he's got the toys. And he needs to learn that. Again, it's this idea of whether the relationship is the one that the master wants or the one that the puppy wants. And in some cases, the master needs to chasten us somewhat severely, particularly if it's something he's told us over and over and over and over again. It's not only not desired by me, it's offensive to me. Again, people have died. And you know what? The same thing is true, I guess, of this next line in here. The balance, says the author, and I'm looking at his piece, between the love of God and the fear of God. We have to be able to do both. We have to recognize we love Him. We can be joyful about it. But sometimes there are things that He has for us that He understands because He knows us better than we know ourselves. He created us, after all. And we had better worship Him the way He wants to be worshiped. And again, I'll suggest the same thing is true of the puppy. There are times where he just needs to learn that there are ways that he wants to be exuberant and they're not appropriate. Back to Yom Kippur and this contrast here. The incense. Remember, they offered incense and strange fire. Aaron was commanded to offer incense in a certain way. One error in the performance of this task, the high priest was warned, could be fatal. And what we see with Yom Kippur, various of the sages have pointed out over the centuries, is that the food and drink of the sons of Aaron that cost them their lives is being replaced this one day, Yom Kippur, this time of the Day of Atonement, by abstinence. Afflict your soul from food and drink. Now, admittedly, that is their understanding. I don't necessarily disagree with it. It says afflict your soul. And I will leave to each individual what that means to themselves. But again, I'm not going to argue with those that say that it means abstain from food and drink, and maybe from other things. I tend to treat Yom Kippur as a very, very solemn day. Again, this is as for me and my house kind of a thing, what we do. And there are some customs, some traditions that we've adopted. Again, they're not explicitly scriptural. I'll probably mention one or two of those over the course of the evening here tonight. But for the most part, The idea is, this is a whole different kind of a day. This is a day that literally the whole day, from sundown on the ninth day until the next evening, where we set it aside to Him. I kind of see it, if you will, a little bit like a performance appraisal time. You know, back when I was a working stiff in the corporate world, you go before the manager and say, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? It's where we get ourselves cleaned up, teshuva. I'm going to make one quick reference. I know there's people that would be disappointed if I didn't at least mention Rashi at one time or another. I saw some of his commentary about a couple things, some of the words that we're going to see in this portion in Leviticus 23 and Numbers 29 and places where it talks about no manner of work. What does that mean? And one of the things that he emphasizes is we are to be cleansed. There will be atonement made, but when he parses the Hebrew very carefully, he says, you got to understand that there are conditionals in there. The atonement is for those who make teshuva. That is at the essence of the process. You got to return to him first. Now, I see the question on the screen from Kevin. What is your soul? That word, and I can check all the places where it's used here, but usually it's nefesh. In the Hebrew. And it literally, remember, animals have souls. The same word is used, Adam became a living soul, nefesh. So there's a whole lot of spiritualization that gets added to it. Body, spirit, and soul. Neshama is the spirit, and nefesh is the soul. You'll even hear people talk about the soulish realm and so forth. So the soul can sometimes tend to have this concept of some animal attachments too. It's kind of the intermediate thing. This is where a lot of our lusts, at least thus goes the teaching over the years, reside. So understand, you got a body, and the body has life breathed into it, which is the soul, and then there's this higher thing still, the neshama or the spirit. Okay, back to the goats. Want to spend just a couple minutes talking about the goats. Again, we have two goats that are being set up here. One is Le Yahuwah, or for Yod Heh Vav Heh. That's going to be for his sanctuary. And the other one is Le Atzatzel. And I do like this explanation. Let me go through a couple of the concepts here with you briefly. And I'm trying to keep an eye on the screen. Why we take a goat and just reject it and shalak it, send it away? This whole commandment, this chuk, seems a little bit bizarre. What is it trying to teach us? And that's the thing I'm going to keep coming back to, too. I think one of the real blessings of these fall feasts, and one of the reasons why I think it's so important, and the thing that I want to continue to emphasize, as we talk to our mishpocha, our families and friends and other loved ones about why we do what we do and why we're keeping his feast, because he says so. But that's not the only reason. There's a blessing. And if we can see what's going on here, there are things we can learn. Very important things that we need to learn. Well, one of those things that seems to kind of stick out is, what can this idea of the goats teach us? And I'm going to keep coming back to this idea of the difference between the things that are commanded by Yahweh, Yahuwah, Yod Heh Vav Heh, that we do, those things which he not only accepts, but are loved by him because he wants us to do them, versus the other things, the things which are offensive to him. And the two goats kind of symbolize that. One of them is accepted by the Creator. The other one is sent away, the scapegoat, representing that he has been rejected by Yahuwah. But there's more. Because tradition says, the Talmud even, and the mitzvah, the way they read this commandment. Now, I'm gonna, as always, say, search out the truth for yourself. See if these things be true. They make a pretty good case, but I wouldn't say that it's ironclad. I hope that's clear. In other words, some of this has to do with traditions and the understanding, and it's cultural. So again, I accept that it's a pretty good understanding, but I'm not going to say thus spake Yahuwah when it comes to the fact that these two goats are supposed to be identical. But again, it rings true for me. Is that clear? Hope everybody understands that. I'm trying to be very careful on that score. So the tradition is for these two goats to be identical in appearance and size and in value, and they're chosen together. We do know from Scripture that it says that one of them is going to be La'atzazel, the other is going to be La'yahua, and they're to be chosen by lot, literally. Okay. Now, if they didn't look pretty much the same, you'd kind of figure, wouldn't you, that there might be a tendency on the part of the high priest or the people to kind of be biased. Well, that one's ugly. Let's send him out in the woods, out in the desert. So I accept, and I hope that you will too, just for purposes of going through the rest of this, that these things should be relatively identical. And that helps to illustrate the teaching. They look like twins, in other words. Well, if that's true, it seems strange. Why would the goats need to be identical, and especially when the purpose is so different? Now, the reason why I think this has a ring of the truth is because, well, it fits perfectly. They're going to be chosen by lot. We don't know which one's going to be which until Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh picks it. The closer they look to us identical, the more the discernment comes in, and the more we can rely on him to make the distinction. Back to twins. You may note that this idea of twins is a familiar theme in Torah. It happens over and over again. Arguably the most famous, Jacob and Esau. Yaakov I have loved, Esau I have hated. The Midrash says one good, one evil. And yet, at least for a lot of their lives, the story goes that they were kind of hard to tell apart. Remember when Yaakov, later on, we know that Edom was red, and that he had red hair and so forth, but it's not probably too much of a stretch to say, when it came time for Yaakov to fool his father, for Jacob to put on that hairy, skin on his arm and pretend to be his brother, well, his voice was close enough, other things were close enough he could get away with if his dad couldn't see him. So this makes sense too. Pause for a second. Look at science and note that when it comes to psychology and lots of things in medicine, science for a long time has decided, hey, twins are great things to study, identical twins, because they will show us the difference between nature and nurture. We can run a test on one twin and see what happens. The evil Joseph Mengele did a bunch of experiments, nasty, evil stuff with twins. But nevertheless, even he realized this idea of the twins. And here's the point. When things look alike on the outside, the sages have said, well, what does that mean? It means in order to discern the difference, you need to look on the inside. Clearly that's the case with Yaakov and Esau. The difference wasn't necessarily as much on the outside as it was on the inside. So look within at the essence in order to discern the difference. The idea of the two personalities, Jacob and Esau, are related to this idea of the two goats. Identical on the outside, but they're different in terms of their essence. And that's why that second goat, the scapegoat, is being offered. And part of the symbolism, if you will, the teaching here is, hey, when it comes time for Yom Kippur, we're talking about somebody, the creator of the universe, who sees within, who knows our hearts. If we're talking about Teshuvah here, well, then it's important that we get right. We can look all we want to on the outside, but it's what's inside that matters. So, the symbolism should be kind of clear. One is for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the other is for Atzatzel. But, by the way, what does that word mean, too? I'm going to try to hopefully tie all kinds of things that we've laid out here conceptually and see if the pieces begin to fit. At this point, I'm going to quote, there's a famous rabbi named Menachem Azariah DeFano. He wrote a book a while back called Sefat Emet. All right, I don't remember what Sefat is, but Emet is truth. And he explains the following. If you look at Ecclesiastes 7:14, you'll find this Hebrew phrase. I'll read it in English first. In the day of prosperity, says the preacher, presumably Solomon, Shlomo, in the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. Elohim has made the one as well as the other. I'm going to let that sink in for a second. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. We know that. Give thanks. Be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. Well, to some extent, the day that's coming up, Yom Teruah, and the times that we may be entering would appear to be days of adversity. So consider, Yahuwah has made one as well as the other. And by the way, this is where this Rabbi DeFano gets this idea. It says Azazel is an acronym. It's an interesting point. And the sentence is the one that comes right smack out of that place in Ecclesiastes. Ze le umat, ze asa elchim. God has made one as well as the other, the good as well as the evil. He made both goats. They look identical. He knows their hearts. We don't necessarily. Ze le umat, ze asa elchim. Azazel. This contrast between good and evil, the recognition that both emanate from Him, the same source, is the essence of the verse. Remember, too, Yod Heh Vav Heh made Yaakov, and He made Esau. In a sense, they go on and kind of wax a little bit philosophical almost. By the way, this is one of those questions that comes up all the time. People always want to get to the heart of it. We're not going to answer this one tonight, but I submit that it's a good thing to think about on Yom Kippur. Why do good things happen to bad people? And why do bad things happen to good people? Why is there evil to begin with at all? Is it just possible that good needs evil in order to exist? Certainly, Yod Heh Vav Heh created those things which we might refer to as evil. He had a purpose, even whether we understand it or not. This article says, well, you know, it may be something no more complicated than good needs something to reject. And it's the contrast with evil that helps us to be able to understand the difference. Problem is, what we tend to do is to adopt the ways of evil and identify with them instead of rejecting them. And all of that basically brings us back to this whole idea of the two goats and what it is that we're supposed to do on Yom Kippur. Oh, and by the way, let's think about the goats one more piece to tie back in together. If the goats look identical on the outside, hey, you know, God knows my heart. He knows that when I'm keeping Ishtar and Christmas, why, that's perfectly okay. How is he able to reject the one goat, send it out, and have the other one acceptable to him? We're talking discernment. We're talking things that, to the people that don't know any better, may look similar. Well, you got your customs, I got my customs. They're all perfectly fine. All paths lead to God, don't you know that? Well, they don't lead to the same God. There are paths that He has specified. They lead to Him. One of the big lies is that all paths do, because they don't. Yahuwah has made that point clear. Yeshua said, you know, the way is narrow, few there be that find it. Scripture says over and over again, veer not to the right or to the left. The clear implication is, there are things that I know and want that are pleasing to me and things that are not. Israel was sent out for whoring. Their priests were told, hey, you failed to teach my people the difference between the tahor and the tameh, the set apart and the profane. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, because you've rejected knowledge. I'll reject you for being priest to me. Similar concept from Hosea, over and over again. We better know the difference between the goats, between the acceptable and good worship of Yod Heh Vav Heh and the things that aren't. And as we get closer and closer, you know, whenever the last days are, it's more and more important that we be able to make that distinction. And again, to be able to tell it to others, to let them know about it. All right, just a couple more comments. We'll begin to wrap this up. I promised you this. I don't think I've done it yet. The story of the Azazel and some of that kind of stuff, kind of the essence of the heart of Yom Kippur, if you will, is in Leviticus chapter 16. And then there's these two other places. There are other places in Scripture where these things show up, but certainly these two are places where when people say, and I've had the question asked at least two or three times in this last week, hey, Mark, you know, where can I go to find out what needs to happen during these coming fall feasts? Well, go to Leviticus chapter 23, and it lays out all seven of them there, starting with Shabbat, and then on through the spring feasts. And when you get to, this is an easy one to remember, Leviticus 23:24, it says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the children of Israel in the seventh month, first day. We had that one just a few days back, Yom Teruah. a memorial proclaimed with a blast of horns, teruah, holy convocation. You are to do no manner of servile work. There is a distinction. There's an adjective there. Now, this has generally been read to say, ah, that means servile work. Probably cooking is okay. So at least the way that that's usually been interpreted is, okay, you can cook on these particular high days. And maybe it means you don't do work for hire. You don't do the traditional kinds of servile work. But you don't get all wrapped around the axle about what constitutes work per se and what doesn't, like you would on Shabbat or especially on Yom Kippur. But then we get to verse 27, we see the distinction. Howbeit, on the 10th day of the same month is the Day of Atonement. This shall be a holy convocation unto you. You shall afflict your souls. And that's, I'm looking for it in Hebrew here. But anyway, it's nefesh kem. You shall bring an offering made by fire unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. You're to do no manner of work, no manner of work on that same day. It's a day of atonement, to make atonement for you before Yahuwah Eloheka, the Lord your God. And I've already read this, but I'll read it again because we're here. Whatever soul it is that shall not be afflicted in that same day, he shall be cut off from his people. That's bad enough, but it gets worse. Verse 30. And whatsoever soul it is that does any manner of work in that same day, that soul will I destroy from among his people. Very serious. All right. Any manner of work, destroyed. But is not afflicted, in other words, doesn't participate, and whatever it means to afflict yourself ends up getting cut off. And then he repeats the no work thing in verse 31. You're to do no manner of work. Oh, and just in case we think it's done away with, you know, like we've been told for years, all that Old Testament stuff, Feast of the Jews, gone, out of here. Nope. It is a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. Right? Any questions? All right, let's take a pause. I got a couple questions here. The one I'm probably going to, I'll give my best quick shot at it, but I'm not going to probably be able to answer this in the kind of detail you'd want. I'll just have an opinion on it, Yaakov. Why goats and not sheep? Simple answer is because he said goats. You know, if I had to guess, and again, that's all I'm doing is guessing, goats are more stubborn than sheep. Ever dealt with them? I don't know, but it seems logical to me that if there's something that represents us, I'm thinking goats makes a better choice. That's just my take on it. You know, your mileage may vary, and I'm sure there's other more insightful things that could be said about it, and a whole lot of stuff. But in any case, if for no other reason that goats are generally in Scripture, you tend to see sheep held up to a little bit different kind of a place than goats for a number of reasons. Sheep, if anything, tend to be a little bit less discerning, too, I guess you'd have to add. You can lead a sheep astray probably easier than you can a goat, for what that's worth. And Yaakov's right. In the end, he will separate the goats from the sheep. So all of that kind of stuff is true. Dodiah asks, no manner of work, what does that mean? Answer, I'm going to read it as literally as I can. No manner of work. You know, it means if it looks like work, I don't do it. When it comes to the Shabbat, we have the very specific things that it says, right? Not to kindle a fire. What does that mean? I can't flip on a light switch. You know, there are Orthodox Jews, Hasidics, and others in the world that essentially say, well, when you flip on a light switch, electricity flows, heats up a little filament, that's kindling a fire. I don't quite agree with that. I've built a fire by hand, you know, with a bow. Try to rub two sticks together, you ain't never going to do it. But with a bow, it's still a heck of a lot of work. To kindle a fire is, no doubt about it, real work. Flipping on a light switch, to my mind, not so much. Or starting up a car. But the point is, there is a little bit of Kentucky windage, as I call it. A little bit of your mileage may vary. People might have a slight different understanding. But if we can have a difference of understanding about what it means to say, shall not kindle a fire, well then how much more so when it says no manner of work? No work whatsoever. I'm just going to err on the side of, when it's Yom Kippur, if it doesn't glorify him, I'm going to try to avoid it. anything that takes the focus off on that one day a year from the singular thing that we need to be focused on, which is Him, and getting ourselves right before Him. Oh, and by the way, getting ourselves right with one another too. Are there people that I need to forgive, and so forth? All of that, but not anything that looks or smells like work, unless there's an emergency. Or, you know, back when we were in town and we would go to the assembly, to the convocation, I'd get in the car. But for the most part, that's His day. We'll turn off the computers, we'll turn off the phones, and we'll focus on Him. And I will. I'm not going to say to other folks, if you don't fast and pray, you're going to go to hell or you're going to be cut off. That's not my call to make. You know, for the head of house, the one who makes halacha for his house, decide what it means to you. And if I had anything to say, it'd be err on the side of caution. Because the no manner of work, if you do that, you get cut off or destroyed. That's pretty severe. When it comes to, if you do any manner of work, you get destroyed, I'm going to say, oh, well, I'm going to be very careful about what constitutes work. It shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest. You shall afflict your souls. And it even tells us, you notice it repeats this several times. From the ninth day at evening, from even unto even, you shall keep your Shabbat. Keep your Shabbat. Let's talk, Numbers 29. I did mention Numbers 29, just by, for purposes of completion here. 29:1. This one says, verse 29:1 starts on Yom Teruah. Verse 7 is where we talk about the 10th day of the month. A holy convocation, you shall afflict your soul. Anav, by the way, there's the Hebrew word anav. I'm sorry, anah. Anah. Anav is meek. But anah is to be occupied or afflicted or oppressed or humbled or even bowed down. I think all of that helps to kind of flesh out the picture. Do things that afflict yourself, that oppress yourself, that humble you before Him, that help you to be properly bowed down. Do no manner of work. The burnt offerings, because we don't have the place for them, we honestly can't do that. Doesn't hurt to read through that and kind of understand what it's saying. I got one other note here, which I will, for purposes of completion, point out. There is one other, the Haftorah, that is traditionally read. Now, there's actually more than one that go with Yom Kippur. Maybe this is a good thing to do on Yom Kippur. If you're looking for some things to say, okay, well, you know, what can I focus on Yom Kippur, besides maybe reading these three pieces of Scripture, too? One of them that's traditionally read is the story, indeed the whole book, of Jonah. Why? Well, I think the reason is clear. The book is all about Jonah's mission to the people of Nineveh, who, like America, were walking in utter rebellion. And they were fixing to be whacked. They were going to be destroyed. As a matter of fact, I've heard it taught, and I tend to kind of accept this understanding. You know, we're not told explicitly, so read it for yourself, see what you think. But there's some reason Jonah doesn't want to do this. Is it because Jonah's stubborn? Jonah just doesn't want to obey God? Well, Jonah's a prophet. I don't think that's the reason. Best explanation I have come up with offered is Jonah knew that if he went to the people of Nineveh and prophesied as he was told to, Teshuvah, turn around, things are really going to hit the fan here, that they would listen. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. They did. And he didn't want it. He didn't like them. He didn't want to go there. Don't send me to those people. Let them die, God. Well, they did repent. Basically, the response that you get from Yod Heh-Vav-Heh is, nope, that ain't going to work. You can do what you want. No, you can't. I'm just going to make sure you end up where I want you to go. Go to Nineveh, Jonah. Go, go, go. Do you understand me yet? Into the belly of the whale? Black! Are you getting the picture yet? Right? And eventually he goes, and what do? They put on sackcloth and ashes, and they repent, and Nineveh is spared, and Jonah doesn't seem to be too happy about it. So, why this story on Yom Kippur? Well, if anything, folks, and particularly this year, maybe it's the contrast that we need to be aware of. Do you think if Jonah was to come to Washington, D.C., and show up in front of the Senate and the Lindsey Grahams and John McCain's and Chucky Schumer's over there and say, repent, for the end is near. God is fixing to wax this country. Do you think they would listen? Goes to the White House?
I don't think so.
I'm guessing that the United States is not like Nineveh in that regard. Maybe I'm wrong. May it be so. But I'd be surprised if I would see the president getting on TV and saying, people, we need to fast and pray because this nation is on the wrong track. It's been on the wrong track for a long time. And the creator of the universe, the one that we haven't even let into our schools for a generation, is telling us he's going to whack us. May it be so. But that would shock me a lot more than Nineveh repenting, even, than did Jonah. Well, again, that's part of the reason why I'm talking about all this stuff and saying now is the time to encourage people who will listen, who have any hope of repenting. This is the day for it. If you've never gotten on your knees before, if you've never fasted before, if you've never spent a whole day doing nothing except focusing on Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and trying to be at one with Him and letting Him cleanse us, this is the day for it. By whatever calendar you want to count it, do it. Set it apart. Do no manner of work. Repent. Teshuvah. Okay, when this is all accomplished, here comes the next part. By the way, I'll admit it outright. Sukkot is my favorite time of the year. Most of you know this. This is another one of those little things. I'll just say it in passing. Maybe we'll talk about it during the time of Sukkot when people are here. And maybe there's somebody that's coming that would want to participate in this teaching as well. You can go through the book. I believe it's Chronicles. And I don't have my notes sitting here in front of me. But you can go through the book. The course of... Yeah, but it's now I've been talking about Nadab and Abihu. It's Abijah, the course of Abijah, which is basically the line that Zechariah came from, the father and the mother of John the Baptist. And if you put all those together and you do the time calculations, essentially you can show that, hey, John the Baptist was 6 months older than Yeshua. We know that this happened at this time. We know that he would have been in the temple at this time. He'd have come home 9 months later. Welcome back, Dad. And his wife, who has been barren, bears John the Baptist. We can calculate the time that Yeshua was born. Answer? At Sukkot. It all fits. So, it's, I think, helpful when people ask questions and they're saying, well, why should we keep these feasts? Point out to them, hey, have you ever been told that mangers is the old English word for sukkah, or plural, Sukkot? Tents, booths? Why were they there? Well, because the emperor knew that those were one of the feasts of ascension. All the men would be coming back to Jerusalem. Have to. Commanded. All fits. So again, all of these things, if you will, are pictures. They are things that happened in the past, not just in the land of the wilderness coming out of Egypt, but they represent other things that were appropriate to the time of the Mashiach. And they also represent, I am firmly convinced, things that we will see again. And they're a teaching thing for us right now. I mean, right now, in the next few days, in going through this time of Sukkot. And I think there's more lessons here than we can probably wrap our heads around, even. If the creator of the universe can teach me something with a puppy, then I think he can teach us something when we walk in his ways and observe his appointed times, too. Question? A question. Are we here on next Shabbat?
Are you planning on doing this here?
Oh, yeah, I was planning on being here next Shabbat. So, yes, we will be here next Shabbat. That's Erev Shabbat. We'll do this service like we normally will do. As for the one that's during the week, we'll probably do it there too. We may have a technical issue to work out, but I think if we can, we'll let everybody know, but we'll try to do it then too. So yeah. That's our plan. You know, if the internet goes down and the creator of the universe decides we're not going to be here, well, he'll let you know. But in the meanwhile, that's our intent. But just so we know, on the 15th day of the 7th month, remember, if Yom Kippur is day 10, then day 15, 5 days later, you are to have a holy convocation. You are to do no manner of servile work. Note that the adjective is back there. You are to keep a feast unto Yahuwah for 7 days. And at the end of those 7 days, then there's another one of these set-apart days. And by the way, in the between there, it specifies all these interesting offerings that are to be made. But, well, because we cannot do this Feast of Ascension, we don't have a temple in Jerusalem. For now, we can think about them, we can memorialize them, but we can't actually do them. There's a bunch of interesting stuff. We'll probably talk about that while we're here at Sukkot, that you can look at those offerings and see what they do, what they show us. Okay, any other last questions? And comments? All right, if not, then let's have another song, and we'll come back in a minute. We'll talk about, I promised, Isaiah 66, and I think it fits with the news, so I'll wait and do that with the news, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. And I got one more comment I want to make after the news. Maybe we'll do this during prayer time. It'll be a little bit of an extended teaching during the time for prayers and praise reports. Because I'm gonna and I want you to think about this. Let's do it something a little bit unusual. During the song, think about this one. And we'll leave this as a cliffhanger. I guess I like that. That comes from my radio background. I have observed something. And I've had any number of people tell me this, and I'm going to try to connect some dots here. And I've observed it over a period of years. It's not just during this time of the year. It's also around Pesach and his other appointed times. Give me some ones on the screen if you understand what I'm talking about and say, oh, yeah, I've seen that too. Give me a one. If you haven't seen what I'm fixing to mention, give me a two. Has anybody else observed that as we approach his appointed times, especially if we approach his appointed times, I will contend, when it's really, really, really important, that the spiritual attacks on your house increase exponentially? Have you all noticed that? I was feeling it today. It's like, okay, got lots to do, and I don't need to be distracted with this or that or the other thing, and so guess what? The spiritual attacks are there in spades. I haven't seen any twos yet. And I've seen some rather emphatic ones. Yeah, so we'll come back and we'll talk about that. I think it's something to be prayerful about. And by the way, I think it goes right to the heart of this idea of the two goats and the his worship versus the things of the world and what we're supposed to learn and what we're supposed to turn to Shuva from and how it is that the adversary doesn't want us doing that at all. And he will throw up everything he possibly can to block that path. And I can tell you from my own family I know that firsthand. Some of this is private stories. But I could tell we were getting close to a feast because certain things were just going to happen. You could practically set your clock by it. So, again, we'll talk about that, too, after the news. I think that's a very important part of what we need to be praying about and lifting one another up in prayer about and understanding that we need to be cleansed from around this time of the Day of Atonement. All right. Let's talk now about some of the things in the news this week. And, again, I'm going to try to draw the connection, in particular and especially this week, because of the time and the seasons, and at least my sense that things are really coming to a head. No, we haven't had the war yet. I actually think that it was the intent that we would have the war by now, but it turns out that Putin's a better chess player than the idiots in Washington. And when Kerry made the comment offhand about, what can they do to avoid war? Well, they could give up all their chemical weapons. Answer, before Kerry's plane even landed, the Russian foreign minister had called and said, you betcha, got it brokered, it's a done deal. They'll give up the chemical weapons, let the UN inspectors in there. Huh? We didn't think you'd actually do it. Checkmate. At least for now. Most of you have heard that. We don't have a war yet, but don't worry. I don't think for a second that they've given up on it. Probably the truth is simply that Yod Heh Vav Heh wasn't ready for it yet. And it'll eventually happen, all of these things, when the time is there. So let's go through. I want to make sure we talked about that up front, because I know probably most everybody's heard about that one. But economics. We had some major interesting stuff this week. I like this one. I'll start with this one just because it's one of those things that doesn't get a lot of press, but it helps to kind of set the stage. The Dow Jones. Remember, the Dow is, as far as most people are concerned, well, that's how we know whether we're in a depression or not. If there's a stock market collapse, then there's a depression. But as long as the stock market's up, then everything's fine, regardless of whether everybody on my block and me and the wife are all out of work. The Dow Jones this week jiggered the figures one more time. They managed to keep things looking good by taking the losers and kicking them out and putting in stocks that perform well, and then they reweight the averages too. So they kicked out Alcoa, Hewlett-Packard, and the Bank of America and replaced them with Goldman Sachs, Nike, and Visa. And the story that came out in Zero Hedge is a pretty good summary. Hey, did you notice that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Dow Jones 30, now only has about 10 companies left in it that might be called actual industrials? The rest of them don't make anything. So how long until the entire Dow becomes one daily rebalanced ETF where we just pick the winners and then make things look good, because if the stocks don't perform well, we kick them out? And what that means, of course, as others point out, is you can't compare the Dow today to the Dow 10 years ago and say, see, it's gone up, because it ain't got the same companies in it. But that's not as bad as what the Treasury does. They just lie about the whole smash. Federal deficit increased by $146 billion in the month of August, according to the Congressional Budget Office. But, wonder of wonders, miracle of miracles, the United States did not go over the debt limit. The debt didn't increase a single dollar. Whoa, how do they do that? Answer, they lie. It's really that simple. And when all else fails, they manipulate the markets. Earlier this week, now remember, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, the FOMC, meets next week. If there's a time when I expect that we might get a war, the Fed meets on Wednesday. If the markets don't like the Fed minutes or the Fed chairman's statement, we might get the war on Thursday. Anyway, here's a story that came out essentially Thursday into Friday today. Did you notice the other day that the crooked casinos, the gold and silver markets, got slammed, hammered again one more time? And it was done when the markets were closed in Europe and in the United States. It was 3 a.m. in the morning. And so for the most part, nobody in the world was watching. And they hit gold hard. As a matter of fact, they hit it so hard that they brought down the entire world exchange for 20 seconds, which is kind of an eternity in computer trading land. And so they drove it below the 1350 support zone. The drop occurred in the span of 1 minute, says one of the analysts here. So it's pretty obvious it was a planned attack with the intent of taking out the support zone and undermining the technicians and the chart patterns and all that kind of stuff. And they did all of this in a thin overnight market when there wouldn't be any buyers out there to defend against sellers who could sell stuff that they know they don't have to deliver anyway. And all of this means that the intermediate trend line has been broken. This is the technical analyst speaking. So the technical traders will be scared now, and they won't want to buy paper gold anyway. All this is good. All this needed to be done because the Fed is meeting. Here's a comment or two from Eric Sprott, one of the best gold analysts around there. He points out that China is still importing 100 tons of gold a month. That's six times more than they imported last year, at least that they're admitting. And he believes that the Fed is not going to taper at their meeting. They're still going to extend and pretend. And so certainly, they didn't want gold to be launching from higher levels. That would have exposed the entire lie immediately. So they pop it back down, hit it hard, and then when it goes exploding upwards again, it ends up right back where it would have been had they not manipulated it. He talks about bonds and redemptions of bonds and the fact that the rest of the world is saying they don't want to play, and you guessed it. Again, it's a really good excuse to need a war. Physical demand's every bit as strong as it has been. After the Fed meeting, probably things will be right back up, and you'll know that's why they bopped it. This story what I'm doing here is I'm laying out a couple things. It sounds almost like a shotgun, and I think if you look and see where the shots from the shotgun lie, hopefully we'll see the pattern. And one of the patterns is this idea of good and evil, good news and bad news, positive things, negative things in the economy, the Azazel, Le Yehua, the two goats. And how we have to look a little bit deeper into these things and discern some of the differences. I got three stories, or two anyway, all just kind of telling where the United States is at in terms of its paganism. One, as a little 10-year-old girl in Tennessee, some little town in Tennessee, was given the class assignment, write about the person you idolize most. And she said, well, my hero is God. I love God. I also love his son, Jesus. And she wrote this little thing, as 10-year-old girls would do. And the teacher said, no, Achtung, you will not write about God. That's not acceptable. So she had to pick somebody else that she could idolize. And it turns out Michael Jackson was just fine. So she wrote about Michael Jackson instead. And there's a message there, I guess. I think it lines up with this one. A Florida official, USDA, they have been distributing food to the poor. The ministry is called Christian Service Center, and they're in, I think it's the Tampa, St. Pete area, Broward County, anyway, wherever that is. And the USDA rep came back and said, we're going to make a minor change to your new contract when we renegotiate here, slight change. You are no longer allowed to have religious information where the master's food is being distributed. So they told us that we had to take all that stuff down. What stuff were they talking about? Well, they were not going to be allowed to participate and give away food unless they removed portraits of Christ, the Ten Commandments, a banner that read, Jesus is Lord, and of course, not going to give away any more Bibles either. They told us we could no longer be allowed to have any religious information where USA food is going to be. The USDA-funded program, has requirements that are outlined by USDA. You know, again, this is not surprising, folks. They're telling us this is a matter of separation of church and state. No, it's not. It's the fact that God can have no other gods before it. The creator of the universe is not permitted in the prince of this world's church. There's no other way to put it. This one's almost funny in a way. There's a little Baptist church down in Texas produced a low-budget film named My Son. The congregation did it. Remember, there's a bigger congregation that's made some famous movies down in Georgia. So this other church did it. They went to the Motion Picture Association of America, who proceeded to slap an R rating on it. Well, it portrayed drug use and simulated violence, which the pastor that produced the film said, well, it wasn't either gory nor gratuitous, and he noted that the same Motion Picture Rating Association gave World War Z, which is bloody as all get out, and a movie called Bully, PG-13s. But they got an R rating. And, oh, by the way, that means that the pastors that would normally be the only marketing sources they have will probably not be telling their congregations to go see an R-rated movie. We rely on pastors to advertise to their congregation, said this guy. We want a level playing field. And he thinks, imagine this, that it may be that the MPAA doesn't like the faith message. Gee, do you think? I talked a little bit ago about the fact that Satan hates the feasts. He hates anything that's associated with the creator of the universe. And we see that becoming more and more and more in your face. And I guess that's part of the message here, this idea of discernment. Azazel versus Le Yehua. And are people beginning to wake up? I think some are. Got a couple more stories that'll make that point. More and more, it's undeniable. So what do people do about it? Well, one of the things that I have observed is when we get close to these times of the feast, and when there looks like there might be a real breakthrough, right? How many of you can relate that you've got a family member that says, oh, I think maybe I will keep the feast this year? Boom! Something will happen. Oh, I guess I can't. I can't. I gotta work. I can't keep Yom Kippur. I gotta work. Boss is calling me in. Or, this happened, so I can't do that. I can't come to Sukkot. Can't do this. Can't do that. Got a perfectly good excuse. God knows my heart. It's okay. He understands. Well, I think right there where it said that the soul who will not participate and gets cut off, and he who will do these other things, I will destroy. Oh, yeah, yeah, he understands. Doesn't it say in there, unless you have to work, right? Unless the boss says no. No, these are serious things. So fully expect that as the victory gets closer and the adversary sees I may lose one, he's going to make sure that little sheep or that little goat has every excuse and every perfectly good, rational, world-accepting reason to say, I guess I can't keep God's feast after all. Right, back to this idea of the news and the things people are waking up. I'm just going to read these headlines because we've done NSA until I'm sick of hearing about no such agency. But it turns out this week, what else do we learn? Well, they were doing the dirty deeds worse and more and longer than anybody ever expected. They've been gorging on U.S. phone records for at least 3 years, secret data. Turns out that when the secret court, this evil anti-constitutional court, was established, there were strict rules put into place as to how the spy agency could violate the Constitution, right? Said no warrant shall issue. Well, we're going to make an exception, but there are strict rules. Don't worry. You can violate a little bit, but you can't violate a lot. Well, so what did NSA do? They violated all of them immediately since day one. Here's the funny part. They carried out thousands of inquiries on phone numbers without any of the court-ordered screening. Get this. This is almost a thigh slapper. Designed to protect Americans from illegal government surveillance. What? Come on. That's what the Fourth Amendment was supposed to do. Y'all took an oath before God to do that. Oh, well, we're just violating a little bit. God knows my heart. You're damn right he does. It's evil to the core. Pardon me, but this kind of stuff irritates me, folks. I got to do one more quote out of this one just because it's such a whopper. That's one of the lessons, says the piece here in Wired, from the pages of formerly top secret documents from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. That's the illegal, unconstitutional abomination thing. And it was as a result of a lawsuit brought by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Now get this. Get this. Intelligence Director, and I put the word sick in there, S-I-C, right? Because this guy is either a liar or an idiot or arguably both. Now, this is the same guy that lied to Congress not long ago. No, we're not tapping your phones. Well, you know, the heck we aren't. But the director of the intelligence director for the United States said that he blamed the unlawful spying, well, they got caught, in part on, quote, the complexity of the technology employed in connection with the bulk telephony metadata collection program. We didn't do it deliberately. No, we're just too plain stupid to understand the technology or the law. I mean, who believes this stuff? The court, the FISA court, the FISC court, that is unconstitutional in its very existence, said that the government explanation, quote, strains credulity. No kidding. And here's what the Electronic Frontier Foundation guy said. Incredibly, intelligence officials said today that no one at the NSA fully understood how its own surveillance system worked at the time, so that's how come they couldn't adequately explain it to the court. This, he says, is a breathtaking admission. The NSA surveillance apparatus was, for years, quote, so complex and compartmentalized that no single person could comprehend it. Oh, especially not the intelligence director for the United States. Give me a break. Yeah, this kind of stuff strains credulity. And, of course, what it says is they are, well, by their own admission, stupid, but we already knew they were liars. The DEA is even worse than NSA, as it turns out, according to another story. Yeah, you thought the NSA was bad, snooping and doing stuff. Well, the DEA doesn't even have the excuse of national security, and they're doing worse. So tell us something else we didn't know. NSA Roundup. Revealed DHS strategy to seize digital information at the borders. Whenever you go through the borders nowadays, we don't need those stinking warrants. They're going to steal your laptops, steal your thumb drives, and so forth. You don't have a right to remain silent. By the way, you don't have a right to not get naked, and we're going to take your computer and take what we want on it. Got pictures of your daughter on there? We want them. Got to, you know, who knows? If it's on there, we want it. Can you buy groceries? Well, don't worry. If you can't buy ammunition, it's probably because DHS has gone on another munitions spree with your money. Yeah, they're buying more bullets. Surprise, surprise. What am I trying to do here? Just lots and lots of stories making the same case. Now that the people are beginning to wake up to the fact that when they tell you that they're not spying on you, they're lying. when they put their hands on the Bible and they swear to preserve and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, they're lying. They're breaking an oath before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And more people are waking up and saying, Shazam! They really are! Global warming. No, they've been lying about that too. No, actually cooling, say scientists. This week, the Telegraph admitted something we've been talking about here for years. Not only that, but all those polar bears that are drowning because they can't swim because of all the polar ice is melting. Well, turns out it's not even the time yet for the normal freeze, and there's been a 60% increase in the amount of ocean covered with ice in the Arctic. 1 million square miles. And it turns out that all of the major climate models are wrong. Not one of these bogus models predicted what's actually happening. Here's the funny one this week. This comes from a fellow named John Hinderaker. And it says there was an expedition to the North Pole. They were going to go up and find out how bad it is, the global warming caused by mankind, anthropogenic climate change. And I think it's funny, if you understand the creator of the universe, here's the log entry. Several severe weather conditions hindered our early progress, and our attempts, basically, to go find a global warming caused by man have now been cut off because ice chokes the passage ahead. And it says they have an ice router whose name is Victor, and he says that we want to give you some understanding of the danger. Residents of Resolute, one of the places on the route, say in 20 years they've never seen anything like this. It's ice, ice, and more ice. And this is early. This has been the coldest season with the most ice since we started Arctic Watch in 2000. No whales. Northwest Passage is still blocked with ice. Some of the bays haven't even melted yet. So, the global warming ice expedition was canceled because of ice. Again, people waking up and seeing it. Some of you heard about Colorado, maybe. Give me a one if you heard about the two evil, traitorous representatives in the Senate, in the state Senate of Colorado, that were not jailed, unfortunately. They have not been tried for treason, unfortunately. But they were kicked out of office. So give me a one if you heard the story. Twos if you haven't. I'll do it quickly, regardless. I know the local rep, you guys here in Colorado probably heard about it for sure, but lots of ones. Basically, there were two folks. I don't even bother to name them. One was the Senate president in a relatively safe district. The surprising one was that down in Pueblo, there's a district that was gerrymandered in order to make sure that it was safe for the Democrats. Registered Democrats outnumbered registered Republicans by about 2-1. And this woman lost her... She was kicked out, as was Morse. This was a recall election. It's only the 36th and 37th time this has happened in U.S. history. They were 0-2 for these treasonous blankety-blanks. And it was only the third or fourth time in U.S. history that essentially a legislative leader has been recalled. And the woman that had the heavily gerrymandered district lost by a landslide, almost 60-40. In spite of what were called irregularities and voter rigging, and in spite of the fact that the pro-recall forces that were basically, for the most part, because of the Second Amendment situation, were outspent at least 10 and probably 20-1. Yeah, I won't do the... Well, I might. I see the quote from the Simpkins there about no markets because she was Hispanic. I've got that one here somewhere. I don't know if I saved that, where she said, yeah, it's because she's a Latina, and people are bigots if they don't want her in office. They don't like her being a Latina. Well, she was replaced by a Latino who said that he would keep his oath of office, and maybe it had more to do with the fact that she's a liar than that she's a Latina. Anyway, so some good news. The bad news is, of course, that people honestly think that getting rid of the pawns here is going to make a difference. What was disgusting to me was both the Senate president, who is out of a job. By the way, there was a great quote. I liked it. The fellow who ran the campaign was a guy named Victor Head. He was the head of the recall these traitors kind of guy, and Morse called him an unemployed plumber. How dare an unemployed plumber, blah, 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 blah. And there was a tweet that came from Victor Head this week, and it said, who's unemployed now? Which I thought was funny. But what Morse did say, and he was echoed in this by the evil mayor of New York City, Bloomberg, who gave lots and lots and lots of money to this failed effort, both of them pointed out, well, okay, you got rid of the people who helped perpetrate the evil, but ha ha ha, the evil still stands. The so-called law still stands. So, yeah, the question from Whistler, I think, the fellow that won the slot instead of Angela Giron is also a Hispanic fellow. So it's not the bigotry, in other words, of the people in Pueblo anyway. At least, right, well, that part's true. And in each case, the Democrat was replaced by a Republican. Again, it's the people are waking up. That's the good news. The bad news is, ultimately, these people, I mean, think about it. 100 years ago, this kind of stuff would not have been tolerated in the United States. You know what would have happened to so-called representatives that rubbed their constituents' nose in it and routinely and in your face violated their solemn oath before God? They wouldn't have been kicked out of office. They'd have been, and I'm going to not be pulling punches here, they'd have been tarred and feathered and ridden out of town on a rail. That's exactly what would have happened. They'd have gotten the message. So what happened here, and basically you can hear it in the way Bloomberg was essentially laughing about the situation, is, ha-ha, we sacrificed a few people, but we got what we want. We're perfectly willing to sacrifice your lives, too, just the way we sacrificed these poor stupid dupes' careers in order to advance our agenda. Texas official, guy that's the head of the Texas Railroad Commission, seeking to become the state's next attorney general, made some comments that essentially say Texas is preparing to become an independent nation. Quote, "We've made great progress in becoming an independent nation, an island nation, if you will. I think we want to continue down that path so that if the rest of the country falls apart, Texas can operate as a standalone entity with energy, food, water, and roads as if we were a closed-loop system." Unquote. He says he's been a very strong opponent, quote, "very strong in leading the charge against the Obama administration." There are people seriously talking about things that are coming down. Again, all this is the good news and the bad news. Got a story here from a fellow, Ben Swan, about 9/11. Remember, the anniversary of 9/11 was this week. More and more Americans are looking back and asking questions. More and more people are not drinking the Kool-Aid. They're not buying the lie. And I won't go through all the numbers, but particularly, he says, when you get to Building 7, remember, this is the third building which collapsed and did not have a plane hit it even. The official story was, well, it happens all the time. Fire, you know. Answer? No, it's never happened in all of history when a steel-reinforced skyscraper has collapsed in its own footprint as a result of a fire. Not once. But the good news is people aren't buying it. 46% of people are either sure or suspect that, this is a recent poll, that what happened to Building 7 was a controlled demolition. 27% don't know, 28% are buying the official line. So there's a plurality there, at least, that are beginning to say, hey, they're lying to us and we know it. All of that is what leads me up to this next one, and again, why I think it's so important that we understand. Okay, it's not enough to get rid of evil representatives. What we need to do is come out of her. It's not enough to understand that the world is headed to a bad place. What we need to do is teshuva, repent, turn around. Understand that this is rot. This is a cancer that goes clear to the bone. Remember the men of Issachar, they knew the times and the seasons, so they knew what Israel should do. Well, what Israel needed to do then and now and always is repent. Turn around. You're going the wrong way. So where am I headed with all the good news and bad news stuff? The two goats, the duped goat and the not-so-duped goat. They look alike on the outside, but inside there's a difference. It's this story. Comes from, it comes through Max Slavo's site, but it comes from a place called the SurvivalPulse.com. And I liked it because it simply says essentially what I've been thinking for a long time anyway, but I liked the way they put this stuff. And that is this, folks. I've talked for a long time about the false flags, the event that seems to be coming, the fact that more and more people are waking up. We need a war, I put that in quotes, because if people realize that their life savings have been destroyed, they get upset, they get angry, they do what people in Egypt did. When this whole worldwide fake system melts down, and it will, because there's never ever been one in history that has not melted down, and of course because Scripture tells us this almighty dollar is an abomination before God. So we know it's going to get ugly. People are waking up a little bit, but I don't think they're waking up enough. You know, will there be teshuva like in Nineveh? Well, certainly not from the leadership. What we've seen in the leadership is when they get caught, they double down. IRS director that lied. Okay, more emails came out today. Yeah. Do we see anybody resigning and saying, okay, you caught me. I'm a lying, cheating scumbag, and I'm really sorry. I repent. No, not at all. If anything, and they started to do that, I suspect they'd turn out to have been hanged. You know, two bullets to the head and then put their head through a noose. And then they'd call it Arkansas. You know, color me a little bit cynical, in other words, when it comes to the level of perfidy that we see in society. So what does all that lead us to? This story here, Survival Pulse, to the untrained eye, right? Those goats look alike. To the untrained eye, it would appear that the masses are waking up. People are becoming more informed. Local news stations are talking more about what used to be called conspiracy theories. One after another after another. NSA doesn't even exist. Oh, yeah, they are tapping your phones. And so forth. No, Obama wouldn't lie. Oh, yeah, well, we did have the ambassador killed because the gun running was going to be exposed, and now there's missiles, too. Oh, no, we wouldn't use the IRS. Well, Nixon did it, and so does Obama. And so forth and so on. Human hearts desperately wicked. Nothing new under the sun. The only thing that happens is as evil is allowed to rot the society to the core, it waxes worse and worse. Okay, so no more conspiracy theories. Opposition to further war in the Middle East has been duly noted, and over 90% of the American people rose up and said, no, we don't want that. We're not buying your stupid story because it's stupid. And because there's more evidence that says that the rebels, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood Al-Qaeda folks that the United States calls evil but supports with money and guns, was at the heart of doing this. Putin, for crying out loud, the KGB leader of Russia, turns out to be a more honest, more integrity, smarter, and all-around better dude than the scumbag at the head of the United States who's trying to get us into another war to cover up his own perfidy. How upside down is this stuff? So the good news is, the American people, over 90% of them, has said no. Congress finally, for once, said, oh, well, I guess we can't do it yet. Again, they're not done yet, but at least they didn't do it yet. The United States, he says, seems to have achieved a small victory, right? Hey, isn't this good? No war. People are waking up. This is a small victory. To the trained eye, this is called the law of diminishing returns. Now think about this. This is the part that's really cool here. This is the crux of the story. The old tactics that were used to deceive and manipulate the emotions of the public have become less and less effective over time. Does this mean that we're winning the fight, that people are getting ready to do a Nineveh and Teshuva, or is something more sinister on the way? He tells us a little bit about false flags. All you guys know what a false flag is, I'm sure. It's used to deceive the public. It's when the bad guy attacks himself and says, see, see, oh, the Patriots over here did this. That's why we got to have, the Anti-Terror Act, the Patriot Act, get rid of the Constitution, whatever it may be. The false flag essentially is a lie where a team attacks its own self and then claims the other team did it. So in the past, the vast majority of the public used to have to rely on the way stream media was their sole source of information. And so the false flag, he says, was extremely effective. However, now people have more access to alternative sources of information. They got the web, and they become increasingly skeptical. They're not drinking the Kool-Aid anymore. And this has been underscored by the recent lack of American support for the latest cover-up war in the Mideast, along with the unprecedented amount of skepticism for things like the so-called shooting. It was a shooting, it's just a question of who done it, in Aurora, Colorado, and the Boston Marathon, and other similar places. People are not buying it. And they're even beginning to suspect that Shazam It may be that some of the folks, you know, with proper plausible deniability, are behind some of these world-shattering events. The elite is what he calls them. So, if the elite really are behind some of the most horrific events in recent history, in other words, the way I'll put it is, if there really is a satanic figure, a force for evil in the world that coordinates the actions of those who serve him, whether they know it consciously or not, then what? Well, what would it take to advance the agenda? Answer: an increasingly overt, even overwhelming series of events, or a single event, that directly affects the entire population. An event so devastating that it would overwhelm the senses. It'd have to hit close to home and trigger an emotional response so strong, so overwhelming, that most, even skeptical Americans, would simply ignore the possibility that they would do anything so horrid. Some of you have heard me. One of my favorite quotes from a movie come from Schindler's List. And I'm going to tell this quick story now. And maybe you've seen the movie. If you have seen the movie, remember, it's towards the end of the movie. There's this Jewish woman. She's probably in her mid-40s, had a really tough life. She was in a nice home when the movie begins. We see her family first tossed out of their home and sent to the ghetto. And then we see what happens to her over time. She goes from concentration camp to concentration camp. It gets worse and worse. She sees her sons and her daughters dragged off. People are killed. Here, towards the end of the movie, she's in this bunk in a camp. And all these women are sitting around. They got girls, they got women, they got this old woman who's in the room. She's just been put into the camp. And she's telling them a horror story. You can see their lights, you know, the candle lights reflecting on their faces, and it's dark and it's quiet. And this old woman says, "Oh, I hear these horrible, horrible stories about this evil place called Auschwitz. And they take the women and the children, and they strip them naked." And you see the women go, And she says, "And they put them in the chamber, and they poison them with gas, and they die." And this woman, who has seen horror after horror after horror, who's been through everything that most Americans can't even imagine, she looks right into the camera and she says, "Oh, that is so horrible. I cannot imagine they would do anything so horrible." And I remember watching it, my reaction, I'm thinking, "Oh, you know, for crying out loud, what's it going to take?" And that's basically it, folks. So what I'm suggesting here, what this guy is suggesting is, the possibility exists that as people get more and more skeptical, and they're not buying the plain old garden variety vanilla kinds of Sandy Hooks and Aurora Colorados and Boston Marathons anymore, because they ain't buying the "we got chemical weapons, red-handed with Bashar al-Assad" whopper. What is it going to take? Does it take a national EMP? Does it take the power grid being down? Whatever it takes, be aware that it may be what we see. This is the kind of thing. This is, again, why I urge people. If you've never repented before, if you've got family that has never seen it before, but they're starting to ask questions. They saw the recall in Colorado. They saw the thing in Syria, and they're starting to say for the first time, maybe, could it be that they're lying? "Oh, but I could not believe they would do anything so horrible." Believe it. Know that the human heart is desperately wicked, and that when this kind of thing happens, and it grows, it only leads one place. And the only answer that we have to it is to teshuva, to turn around. All right. Questions, comments, anything else on it? I'm gonna we're running a little bit long tonight, but I'm gonna do one other thing. I just briefly want to address that spiritual issue, and to some extent, perhaps I already have. I'll say it this way: I think a lot of people have observed that this spiritual battle is really where we're at. And that's why I'm talking about Yom Kippur and how important it is. I genuinely do believe. I believe more strongly than I can perhaps, if I haven't already laid it out for you, can lay it out. We are talking about a spiritual battle. We're talking about a spiritual battle that's going to be manifested in a physical way so that lots and lots and lots of people are going to die. Lots of sheep and lots of goats are going to be killed. Lots of good people, whatever that means, are going to be killed as well. And that what we need to be doing at this point, yeah, it's important. Okay? Preparing and having food and having alternative sources of power and heat and being out of the cities and having silver on hand and having cash on hand and having water and, you know, all that kind of stuff is important. But you know what? If we're not keeping Yom Kippur, if we're not walking in obedience to the things that he says are most important, I had this discussion just a couple days ago. You know, hey, this is important. Mark, I got to get this. This is really, really important. I got to do this. Well, excuse me. That's not what your father's telling you. He's telling you you got to do this other thing. He's telling you that if you work on Yom Kippur, if you don't afflict your soul, whatever that means, and it's not up to me what it means, it's up to you and him what it means. You're going to have to go before him and answer for it. If you're not doing that, whatever you're doing, it's a waste. It ain't going to matter for squat. He says he'll cut you off and that the soul that does that will be destroyed. Hey, you think your food is going to help you out? Your water? Your silver? Give it a rest. Oh, I cannot imagine if they would do anything so horrible. They will. Because whether they know it or not, they're serving the adversary. And what he is doing and what he is preparing is not good. He comes but to kill and destroy. It's true. So recognize all that. Put all that together. As the old saying goes, put it in your pipe and smoke it. No, don't do that. Recognize that what we got to do is get right before the Creator. He promises that if we will teshuva, he'll clean us. He'll cleanse us. He'll honor his covenant. It's the best promise we got in this world. So, I hope and I pray, folks, that all of us can give account for what we believe, and we'll have the opportunity here over these next few days even to do that and to reach people and to blow that shofar, because the sword is coming upon the land and we can see it. And some of them can too. And we know what we need to do about it.